Welcome to the Performance Recipe Podcast with me, Richard Stewart, a performance nutritionist and personal trainer. We all know we can get tangled amongst the facts and fads on social media, and so the purpose of this podcast is to bridge the gap between science and practice by having industry experts on all topics performance related. I became a performance nutritionist because of my background in Michelin star restaurants and being a personal trainer, bridging the gap between food and fitness. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome to episode 6 of the Performance Recipe Podcast. Next up, we have Harvey Fortas, a researcher at Liverpool John Moores University in England and an expert in exercise physiology and nutrition, particularly for endurance sports like marathons. Thanks so much for joining me on the Performance Recipe Podcast. I've had you as a tutor once upon a time, so it's a massive privilege to have you on. You're an expert in your field, but I'm not going to bramble on too much. So if you can introduce yourself and tell people a little bit about your qualifications and your experience, that'll be a great start.
Yeah, no, first and foremost, thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to chatting. It's not often you get to talk about this stuff with someone who's interested in it. So, it's a good opportunity. So I guess I wear a few different hats day to day, if you like. Predominantly I'm a researcher at Liverpool John Moores University in exercise physiology and nutrition, where my work focuses on nutrition and specifically endurance sports. I'm also an active performance nutritionist as well, working again predominantly with endurance athletes. And across both my research and consultancy, I've had the kind of privilege to work with an array of sports and abilities, all the way from beginners to elite athletes. So, it's great what you kind of see and everything in between. I guess to close the loop as well, I try and take part in endurance sports as well a little bit, and I'm quite reluctant to say I'm an athlete by any means, but give it a go. That's probably a good introduction.
Absolutely. Best person I could have probably asked. So thank you again. Loads of people that listen to the podcast will either participate in endurance sport to some capacity or have someone they know that is interested in the same topic. So it's nice to have you on and give people a bit of clarity about fueling strategies, etc. So if anyone hasn't figured out, this is about fueling for essentially endurance sport, marathons in particular. So I want to just start off with the basics, and we'll just go through for the next half an hour to 45 minutes. What would you say are the key nutritional components required for marathon training?
Yeah, so obviously marathon is, and the training is a kind of intense and prolonged process, and it takes place, and significant demands on the body. I think the demand on kind of marathon training proposes a few different components, and in general, I think the components and the nutritional components required for anyone are the same. It's just the specifics behind that will differ depending on, the training demand and whether we're training at all. I think, like I say, the demand of marathon training will kind of depend on and dictate a few different factors that you might consider, such as the athletic ability of the athlete, whether they're looking to just complete the marathon versus whether they're looking to compete it and maybe, more like kind of professional standards, their training history, their kind of time they've got to prepare for the event, and a number of factors will dictate kind of these focuses. But the main components are, of course, kind of macronutrients, so carbohydrates, proteins and fats. Of course, micronutrients as well, and I'm sure we'll go into all of these in a bit more detail. And last but not least, kind of hydration too. And I think, like I say, all of these components are going to be important for any diet, regardless if you're training or not. It's just the specifics behind them will become a little bit more, specific for marathon training. And I think I kind of use the three T's to kind of place this. So you've got total, type and timing. And these are ways to frame kind of how we might look at each individual one of these components. And like I say, we'll probably go into more detail over this.
Awesome. Yeah. So absolutely want to start off with carbohydrates for sure, because everybody hears about on one spectrum, you've got carbs are bad, let's stay away from carbs. And then you speak to a performance nutritionist or, well, coaches in general, they'll say to you, what are you talking about? Carbs, king of performance. So,
Let's start with carbohydrates. So the intake of carbohydrates even affect marathon performance?
Yes, I think this question alone could be worthy of like an entire episode or several, but simply, carbohydrates are vital for endurance performance, such as a marathon. They are the most efficient and utilized source of energy during prolonged and high intensity exercise. Now, the role that carbohydrate has on endurance has been partly understood, at least for a long time. I think one of the first studies in sports nutrition, actually, which was over 100 years ago now, reported that marathon performance was correlated with carbohydrate availability. So they saw that those finishers with faster finishing times, that it was the Boston Marathon, they had higher amounts of glucose, which is the circulating sugar or carbohydrate within the bloodstream. They had higher amounts of this than those with slower times, who had much lower glucose, indicating that glucose or carbohydrate impacts performance. Since then, our understanding has developed, and many studies have shown that carbohydrate availability directly influences performance outcomes in endurance events like marathons, and it has the ability to improve exercise capacity and actually delay fatigue. And a lot of this can be attributed to those initial observations, in that we're able to maintain that like blood glucose levels within our body for longer periods of time. And I'm sure we'll discuss maybe more of this in details, and around how much we need, when we need it, and things like that. But simply, it will improve performance. It's just how we best do that might differ from one person to another.
Awesome. Great take. Because people just generally don't understand that it is all down to context as well. Like you're saying before, that if you're just looking to finish a marathon and you're not really just looking to win it or get as far ahead as you possibly can, like, I suppose your fueling strategy is going to have to be a little bit different, I suppose, or can be a little bit different. Whereas with people don't really realize how fast some of these elite marathon runners are actually running. Like, they're probably running the whole distance as fast as I sprint. So the intensity is pretty high, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, moving on from carbohydrates, like you said, but I'm going to go into more detail for sure. So what are the roles of proteins and fats then in endurance training and performance?
Yeah, I think this is quite a good thing to discuss, because I think carbohydrate gets a lot of the limelight, particularly for its direct effect on performance, and perhaps it gets a lot of the limelight for good reason. Whilst protein and fat might not directly improve performance, in that we won't have a supply of protein or fat before or during a race, that won't allow us to perform better, they are still vital for everyday life, and in particular for something like marathon training block, when our body's demands are going to be quite high. So although it might not directly improve our ability to run faster, if we consume it adequately day to day, we will be better able to meet our energy requirements, adapt from training, and actually recover better. So over time, we'll allow our training to be more successful, and therefore that will have an impact on performance in some way. I think proteins, we know, are well reported to be important for the repair and rebuild of muscle tissue, but they also play roles in metabolic processes and our immune health. Alongside carbohydrate, fat is the other main energy providing nutrient and energy store within the body. And unlike carbohydrate, which we can discuss shortly, which has pretty limited storage capacity, our body's fat reserves are enormous and almost infinite. Within our bodies, we have energy stored in fat to perform tens, if not hundreds of marathons, but sadly it isn't quite as simple just to do that. And this is because we struggle to access and use that fat at higher intensities. Fat use for energy is most efficient at those lower and moderate intensities. However, like protein, fat is obviously important day to day and maybe gets a bad rap simply because of its name. It's energy dense, so typically provides high calories for less food substance, which on higher training days where our calorie requirements are a lot higher, provides an efficient way to consume enough. But beyond that, they're also essential for athletes to provide sustained energy sources during endurance activities. support things like hormone production, aid the absorption of fat-soluble vitamins. So that's vitamins A, D, E, and K. I've maybe missed a few. They also contribute to that cell membrane function. So all the cells in our body are boarded in fat as well. So, you know, we need fat to keep that cell kind of integrity and health. So hopefully they kind of are appreciated in their role for health as well. Like I said, I think it gets a bad rap because it's of its name and association. But yeah, no, I think these both indirectly improve our performance and at least not our training.
Yeah, because I think a lot of people will look at carbohydrates and say like, oh, I've got to get the calories in, but trying to eat enough carbohydrates for your, if you're doing every single day long runs, like one of my clients is doing low intensity, long distance, twice a day at the moment with his coach. And yeah, the amount of calories he's having to consume is ridiculous. And there's no way you can do that without his fats. So yeah, that makes complete sense. And then obviously people do tend to forget how much of an effect protein actually does for like adaptations. And people forget about their health. It's not just performance. Yeah. Getting it to the end of a race is about looking after your mind and your body as well.
And I think protein is as well like discussed in the strength and conditioning world and maybe left behind a little bit in the endurance world a bit, but it's equally as important.
Yeah. So we talked about fat being having like a bad rep, but one aspect of food which is forever getting a bad rep, and that is processed foods. And you actually made a post, which I really appreciated, which said, in a world of demonizing unprocessed foods, they're great for performance, something to that effect.
And yeah.
I'd just like you to just elaborate on that a bit more.
Yeah. So I think if we think about what processed foods are, it's such a broad term anyway. And I think, of course, in a well-formed diet, the focus is always going to be on whole nutrient dense foods, like real foods. And like, in my opinion, yes, that should form the foundation of any diet. However, processed foods can play an important role. You know, if we're talking about endurance athletes here in their diet and you know, for marathon nutrition as well. So you know, there's for several reasons. It could simply be through convenience. It might be more palatable for people. It might be because it's energy dense, which sometimes is considered a bad thing, but when we're trying to achieve high energy demands, that's actually a good thing. I think also if you think about like actually what we're taking on during exercise, like sports drinks, energy gels, bars, these things are all processed, but they provide efficient, quick energy, which is like digestible. It's easy to consume around exercise. These products are often designed to meet you know, kind of the specific needs of endurance athletes, providing the energy and sometimes in terms of hydration as well, without the risk of things like GI or gastrointestinal discomfort. And whilst, of course, balancing all of these with whole foods in a diet and to ensure overall like nutrient adequacy, we must also understand that, you know, processed foods can be functional for our athletes essentially. And this question and topic is becoming more relevant, I think, at the minute, and a discussion I do have more often with increasing messaging and like vilification of processed foods. Whilst I think probably the message stemmed from like a good place of intent, in that worldwide general populations consume more and more processed foods, which obviously have associations with, you know, potential and links to like health outcomes like metabolic diseases such as insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular diseases. You know, these messages have now infiltrated other populations where it maybe wasn't initially designed for, like sports and athletes. And whilst I support the movement to reduce processed food consumption, on the whole, like we've also got to understand what we're kind of talking about here. And I feel quite strong about it. And whilst it deviates a bit from the topic of today, if we then apply it to athletes, it actually probably doesn't apply. And when I see people try and apply it to them, you see people not just trying to reduce processed foods, but actually avoiding them entirely. And then they're unable to maybe effectively meet their energy requirements. They end up tired. They end up sick, unable to train and perform as they perhaps should. And then we can get, there's a whole discussion around like what we define as process. I think if we're going to do it to the definition, unless we live off the land of things we grow, almost everything we eat is going to be processed to some degree. And I think, you know, does that mean everything we eat is bad? I don't think so. And then, you know, yeah, if we apply this to athletes and marathon training, we must understand, like I say, this message probably isn't intended for these people. I think if we even look at things like the physical activity guidelines and these initiatives, which are 150 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity in a day, then that's intended for the general population to achieve a healthy lifestyle. If I'm a coach, I'm not going to then apply these guidelines to my athlete who's currently doing 10 hours a week for their marathon training. I'm not going to then say, okay, all you need to do is 150 minutes. They're not going to train as well. So I think if we then look at our nutrition information as well, we've got to apply the same kind of criticism and just critical thinking behind that really, and understand that not all of these things are intended for everyone. And even for people who aren't training, I guess like a last point, I think there's a lot of scaremongering and aggression towards certain foods, whether you're an athlete or not. Foods can and probably should be enjoyed by people. And it's just like we always hear when we're younger, like it's moderation, right? So it's just like, don't be scared of certain things just because of something you read or watched somewhere. Think more deeply about it.
Absolutely. Well said. I think that gives some people some food for thought. Like there's so much demonizing of processed foods, and people just don't understand how important they can actually play in our everyday lives, even if it's outside of performance. So yeah. I hope Professor Graham Close actually said something that struck my mind, and he was saying, let's say he's traveled down to South America for an event, and they get to the hotel and the food has literally got cockroaches in it. Yeah. You're not going to go and tell your staff members or your athletes, so you have to eat the whole food with cockroaches all over it when you've got a protein shake in your bag. Yeah. Or you just finished the gym and you're not going to pack to smash out a rotisserie chicken when you've got a protein shake in your bag. It's all about context as well. And everything has a part to play, but it is balanced, as you say.
Yeah. And when I talk to people and they find out that I'm into nutrition and kind of work in that realm, people often assume that that's these types of foods or things that are highly processed are going to be things that I tell them not to eat. And actually it's often a lot of the time the opposite. I think not only are these foods okay, sometimes they are the best option, like you say there. And actually it's more effective than something that's like a whole food, you know, to support training or like you say, just for convenience. It's just looking a bit more deeply and taking a bit more thought behind things.
Absolutely. So talking about volume of food, I want to talk about the concept of carb loading as well. So can you explain the concept of carbohydrate loading and its benefits for marathon runners?
Yeah, so this kind of concept of carbohydrate loading is a strategy that's used, like I said, particularly by endurance athletes, and it's to maximize the amount of glycogen or glycogen storage form of carbohydrate, and it's to maximize these stores within our body before a race. So this glycogen stores are the primary fuel during prolonged exercise and high intensity exercise as well. So increasing its availability can then help delay fatigue and enhance performance when we're kind of subsequently exercising. Unlike how I mentioned before with fat, body's glycogen stores are relatively small, which makes kind of managing them pretty crucial for endurance athletes like marathon runners. These kind of storage capacities are dependent on each individual. The more trained people are, the more they can store. The more muscle mass you have, the more you can store. But regardless of these, the stores are quite limited and they can be actually rapidly depleted by kind of high intensity exercise. And this is when we see like this drop, you know, once glycogen levels drop significantly, this is when athletes will experience that kind of dramatic decline in performance, and often referred to as like hitting a wall or bonking in cycling. And this is just characterizing that fatigue and drop in pace if we're running, difficulty to actually manage effort. You might feel a bit more like foggy, blurry, and that's because our brain feeds off this fuel. So when we're kind of running out, we can't think as clearly. So I guess giving these limited size of our glycogen stores, and like I say, day to day, we can actually deplete them to some extent. Carbohydrate loading before an event aims to maximize these reserves to then provide more energy to stores. So this involves just adjusting your diet in the days leading up to an event to significantly increase your carbohydrate intake. Now, there's quite a lot of science to support the effectiveness of carbohydrate loading. Now, this initially was quite a big theme of research in the 1960s, and that was when the muscle biopsy technique was originally developed, and that just involves taking a small chunk of muscle from athletes, and then you can examine that for various things, including glycogen content. And in the early days of this research, it was quite quickly shown that glycogen like levels within those biopsies were strongly correlated with exercise capacity, and that basically means that the greater amount you have stored before your exercise, the longer it takes for you to fatigue. So you can keep cycling or running before you stop. Since then, loading's gone through like a few different phases, if you like. It went through a point where it was very more extreme than it is now, and that people were told to do depletive exercise and exhaust their body, like get rid of all the glycogen carbohydrate stores within their body for like maybe a few days, and then have like a high intake of carbohydrate following that to try and stoop and compensate their stores. Now, whilst that was an effective approach, it is pretty dramatic, and before a race like a marathon, you don't want to be doing like really hard exercise. And then so more recent approaches have really simplified this, eliminating any kind of depletive exercise, and instead now we focus on, like, you typically see athletes taper the week before, so they'll reduce their exercise volume, and then you can just straightforward increase your carbohydrate intake the days before a race, which is a much more nice way to do it. And I guess some factors to focus on a carbohydrate load, because it's something that I see done wrong quite a lot still. It's focusing on easy, digestible, low fiber carbohydrates, like, you know, white pastas, rice, breads, and like potatoes, for example. And these can then just increase these stores without too much like gut discomfort as well. And it only takes kind of 24 to 48 hours to do this as well, as opposed to maybe a full week or 2 weeks. That was maybe previously thought. And to put a number on it as well, we typically aim for like 8 to 12 grams per kilogram. Body weight. So if you just times your body weight by kind of 8 to 12, a number within that, that'll give you a good idea of where to start. And I think in conversations I've had recently with people doing kind of like marathons or triathlons and things, you often hear people refer to their carbohydrate load, or what they perceive as one, as like a big bowl of pasta the night before. But actually it's a bit more than that, and it can be a full day to 2 days before a race. And I'd actually encourage people to do almost all of their loading before it even gets to the evening, and front load their days, so that when it comes to the night, you're not cramming loads of food down, going to bed stuffed and like feeling really full. You know, that can easily impact our sleep quality, which probably has more harm than good. So, getting kind of ahead of it early and just like a gradual increase throughout the day. So I think, I'm not sure if you've got any other questions on that, but yeah, it's one that I think has a lot of confusion, but it can be more simple than people think. And it's also more than just a big meal before a race as well.
Yeah, like I was going to break that question down a bit more, but Yeah, you've literally just hit the nail on the head on every single aspect of that question. I think anybody that would have cleared up a lot of questions, I think a lot of people do misunderstand a carb load. They just think just eat a bunch of carbs the day before and that's you sorted. They don't realize 8 to 12 grams of your body weight is actually a hell of a lot of carbohydrates. And then, like you say, fiber slows down gastric emptying. So obviously that could cause some GI discomfort. So
yeah,
try to keep the fiber down. But
yeah, I think as well, just quickly, it's something that needs to be like a bit practiced or tried beforehand. I think you'd be silly not to. If you've got a marathon block coming up and for some of your longer runs, just trying out, even if it's not the full thing, like a mini carb load the days before, just to work out what a right amount is for you. Like 8 to 12 is a good ballpark, but it is a guideline. It's not an instruction. And I think just playing around with that, you know, you might feel a bit different. You want to find out what foods do work for you. And actually, this is probably
Hello.
Oh, I've got you back.
There we go. Sorry, continue.
Where did I get up to?
So you're saying it's a good idea to front load your carbohydrates, and then you went on to say that it was beneficial to try carb loading before you actually do the proper event, just understand like where's your threshold essentially.
Yeah. So it's definitely like on your long runs and things in your training, it will benefit your training anyway, but it's also good to practice these things. So like I said, before a long run or like when it's getting to your longer runs, just practicing a version of a carb load to understand where you fit on that scale. You know, 8 to 10 or 8 to 12 is a guideline, not an instruction. It doesn't mean that you have to fit within there. And it's something that can be built over time as well. So you might start at 6 and then go to 8 to 10 to 12. You might never get that high, but it's just experiencing these things and never leaving anything new till the race day. We hear that a lot, but it's good advice.
Definitely. So that's something else I'm going to talk about a little bit later, I think, is with the training the gut. So we'll get to that. So because it's not just about training for the actual marathon from the physical aspect, but there's the nutrition side. You've got to train the nutrition too.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But then, so talking about obviously carbohydrates now, obviously there's fats and proteins. Is there an ideal macronutrient and ratio for marathon runners during training and on race day, or is there not one at all?
Yeah, I'd say it there probably is, but it would vary from individual to individual, and their preferences, the type, you know, the phase of training they're in, the goals, you know, are they again looking to do 2-hour marathon, or they're trying to just get around. I think as a general rule of thumb, I'd keep things like fat and protein pretty similar day to day. And that biggest variation will be carbohydrates. So when we have a bigger energy requirement on a day, because we're expending more via exercise, the bulk of this will be made up by an increase in carbohydrate, mostly because of the reasons I listed before around that carbohydrates, the predominant fuel used during exercise, and its depletability. So you want to keep it kind of turning over at a kind of sensible rate. And it's hard to put numbers on these things, but kind of typically fat contributes to around say 20 to 30% of energy provision in a diet. In terms of protein, around 1.6 to 2 grams per kilogram. So say you got a 75 kilogram athlete, that would be 120 to 150 grams. And you know, we might look to increase that if and when training volume also increases. That might just see protein increase slightly to deal with extra recovery, or in periods of energy deficit, which is probably won't be something we talk about too much today, but you know, when we obviously burn more calories than we expend, protein can be used to increased as a means to reduce that muscle breakdown. Simply, carbohydrates make up the rest. And if we look at the guidelines, that would be, say, 6 to 12 grams per kilogram per day for an endurance athlete, which is a huge difference. If we look at that 75 kilogram athlete, that's 450 to 900 grams a day. I didn't do the maths, and I just remember hearing that before. I'm not very good at maths, but there's a huge difference there. So it's not something to just like go, okay, I need 450. That is the main thing I'm trying to get across here and to take home, is that, you know, where we really will be changing what we're eating, and the thing we'll be changing is carbohydrate, really. And that is quite simple to do. We can essentially make the same meals, we just vary the carbohydrate source in that. Like I say, these are like just guidelines, and you see rates exceed these 12 grams. I remember reading a case study of a Tour de France rider, and they were hitting over 18, 20 grams per kilograms on big mountain stage day. So it's something that, you know, it's different for everyone and the demands we're doing, but yeah. I don't know if there's an ideal ratio. I think it's not that simple, but it also doesn't need to be that complicated either. We need to break it down that far all the time for everyone. But yeah, 18 grams is crazy, isn't it?
18 grams is wild. I can't even imagine how they did that without feeling sick. That is some hard work. Okay, so we've got down the macronutrients. Fantastic, awesome. So I was going to ask you about what would you recommend the night before a race, but you've already answered that. So you're looking at your white rices, pastas. Is there anything else? Would you recommend like protein-based bars? Would you recommend any sort of fruits or oil? Because obviously there's the fiber content with that. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, so I think the evening before, like if we're looking at dinner, I'd keep it really simple. I wouldn't be going, if I can avoid it, out to eat anywhere. You know, often people travel for marathons and they might not have that luxury. So if they do, it's checking what's on the menu, what looks quite clean, if that's a word. I don't really like using it, but you know what I mean. I'd say, yeah, like those kind of white rices, some protein source. It doesn't need to be a lot, and something that's going to taste nice. It's also a time you want to relax a bit before a big event, so you've got to take that into consideration too. But by dinner time, I'm hoping all the loading's done anyway, so it's just really topping it off, and something that you're going to digest quick. And then, like I say, that your focus then on now should be the sleep as opposed to anything else.
Yeah, sleep is the most underrated form of performance, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. People really do neglect their sleep. They're like, oh, I've got 6 hours in. It's like, no.
Yeah.
Get a bit more. So moving on from the macronutrient side of things, let's talk about hydration. You did say that is another important factor. So how important is hydration really in the days leading up to a marathon and on the day of the marathon?
Yeah, I think this is a good topic as well, especially when you come on to like during the marathon and such. But I think it plays a critical role in our performance ultimately. Even mild dehydration can impair physiological functions and performance. However, like a lot of things, there's this individualization, and it's not uncommon to see athletes finish a marathon dehydrated. In fact, almost everyone who does finish dehydrated. It's just to what degree. You know, some of the best finishing times are also matched with levels of dehydration that can be quite high. To caveat that, a lot of DNFs and slow times are also attributed to dehydration as well. So it's certainly something we need to be mindful of and actually prepare for. It's also influenced obviously by certain factors, most like obviously the weather conditions and the heat, which can influence and then significantly increase our fluid losses and dehydration. But also like how long is it going to take you to actually do the marathon? How hard you're going to push will affect how kind of much you're going to lose and how hydrated you need to be going in. I think leading into the race, hydrated is really important, and where I place a lot of the focus actually in terms of your hydration plan, both in the days and the morning of. And it's just, I think in the days it's quite simple. It's just staying well hydrated. Now I know that's a broad term, but monitoring what you can, you know, like urine color, to ensure that remains like light, but not completely clear, and being mindful of your perception of thirst. I think actually these, you know, given I often work in around quite fancy equipment and things, we then give this type of advice to people sometimes to, because these are practical cues that actually work. You know, I think if we actually often ask ourselves, how thirsty am I? You might realize actually probably time for a drink. I think it's something that people don't do. I think just being extra mindful in the days leading up to a race around that, and just having some fluids with every meal, and then kind of making sure you're, if you're doing any small training sessions, again, hydrating appropriately during that, but also after that, and rehydrating well. I think when it comes now down to race day as well, you know, runners should continue to hydrate, and maybe, like, without the risk of making it sound too complicated, is to avoid over drinking as well, which can lead to, you know, hyponatremia, which is where we concentrate our blood basically with a ratio of like water to sodium beyond what we probably should be doing. So on race morning, I'd ask athletes to again observe their urine color. If you compare it with urine color chart, which correlates to different levels of hydration, score their perception of thirst, which is again on a scale. Putting these two things together, you can estimate how dehydrated or hydrated someone is, and then you go from there. I think you're probably familiar with those scales as well from some of the case studies, maybe, if you remember that far back.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
They're like useful tools they're really quick and easy. You don't want to be doing too much on race morning, but just asking these questions, looking, and then kind of going into the race hydrated is really important. And then like during the marathon, the goal is, I mean, in an ideal world, is to replace fluids lost through sweat with fluid intake. But like I say, lots of people finish dehydrated. So this suggests that it doesn't need to be perfect. It just needs to be enough to avoid that excessive dehydration, really. And really this is going to be very individual into how much we need, based on each person's sweat rate. So I would recommend doing some form of like sweat rate test or something to get an idea around how much you actually lose during exercise. And that gives you a number. The more you do that, then the better you record that test as well, the more accurate. And it gives you a good understanding of how much you need to have during the race. But I think, yeah, it's something that people are not sure how to approach, particularly their hydration and electrolytes as well. It's another big topic of discussion at the minute. And that's definitely full of confusion as well.
No, definitely. I think I'm getting onto electrolytes soon, but with your hydration, what would you say? So besides obviously using a urine scale chart and thirst, is there anything else that you can think of the top of your head that's good for indicating hydration, just to give people a general guideline in terms of hydration? For example, I sometimes say to my clients, obviously, like, I'm not talking about going for a marathon run, but just in everyday life, 1 liter per 23 kilograms of their body weight is like a rough guideline. Is there anything else that you can recommend at all?
Just a quick break. If you find this information useful, please like, subscribe, and send this to a friend. Otherwise, let's get back to the conversation.
Yeah, it's difficult because of, in this context, it's obviously endurance athletes who are going to be training a certain amount. So I tend to tell people to have at least kind of 5 to 750 mils per hour that they exercise. And that's if we're not doing any kind of sweat rate test. And that's just because it fits in an average where people lie. So I think if you can probably stick to your kind of rules there day to day, but then also understand that during exercise, you're increasing these losses. I think during an endurance exercise, if you can get through 500 to 750, like I say, mils per hour, which conveniently is a bottle of water or like a sports bottle, get through one of them an hour and you'll be fine. And then the work's not done then, it's replacing that after exercise. And again, I'd probably go for about a litre and a half over 90 minutes. Just, it tends to work for people. It's an achievable amount. And again, that's probably usually two bottles. So it's easy to visualize for people.
Awesome. Perfect answer. Exactly what I was looking for. Thank you, mate. So let's talk about the consumption of carbohydrates during the race. So how often should a runner consume carbohydrates during the marathon, and what form? Gels, drinks, etc. And how much should a runner consume?
Yeah, so I guess this is again one of those that I could probably waffle on for a while, but like they are going to be pretty important during the marathon. They serve as that primary source of energy for the muscles, and we rely on these kind of provision throughout the marathon, and things like the amount, the timing and the type, which comes back to those three T's, total, type and timing. That's going to be a little bit different for everyone. But if we look at how much people should go for, now, if we were to solely look at research, this indicates a huge range from anywhere from 30 to up to 120 grams carbohydrate per hour during this type of exercise. I think if we kind of work our way through that range, we might be able to kind of fit where people kind of lie on that range. So, if we kind of consider 30 to 60 grams per hour to begin with, this range is suitable for most athletes. It's quite manageable, especially at that lower end. It's supported by studies dating over 40 years, and they demonstrate that consuming this 30 to 60 grams per hour maintains blood glucose concentrations for the most part, like preserving liver glycogen, perhaps, and actually improving performance by maybe kind of 2 to 3%, which can be quite significant. If we then move it up to kind of 60 to 90 grams per hour, this is essentially for those who can tolerate more. They may benefit from consuming this amount more because they're able to, you know, we see from research that not only can our body actually take up more, it will actually use more if it's given more as well. So our muscles will utilize higher rates. And then again, more recently, we see rates over 90 grams an hour being consumed. Now, this is a lot, and it's for people who are training their gut kind of extensively, as we kind of alluded to that concept earlier. Maybe more for like elite athletes who are working at a really high intensity. So elite athletes who are performing a marathon or running really hard, like you say, they're probably out of sprinting. So they're actually utilizing really high rates of carbohydrate, and they're able to utilize all this 120 grams. To caveat some of this as well, like cycling formulates a lot of our research in this area to like at the minute, especially at those higher amounts. And typically that's a bit easier to kind of digest and tolerate food. So we often see people like go for a bit less when they're running. I think triathlon's a good example for that. People could tolerate 90 grams on a bike, and then they have to drop to say 50, 60 when they're running. So, I think starting from 30 to 60, working out like how that feels, getting comfortable and perhaps building on that is a good place to start. I think if we then look at like the types of carbohydrate as well, I think that becomes particularly relevant when we're looking at above 60 grams per hour. And that's simply because, this requires multiple transportable carbohydrates. Now this sounds complicated, but it doesn't have to be. This is essentially glucose or maltodextrin combined with fructose. And these are just all different types of sugars essentially. And they use different channels to transport from our gut system into our blood. So using these individually, we can probably tolerate around 60 grams of a single sugar per hour. And then after that, these channels are essentially full and at max capacity. If we combine them and use together, we can essentially absorb and oxidize more. So when we're kind of going for over 60 to 90 grams, we'd say mixed or multiple transportable carbs. That's, you'll see a lot on sports nutrition products, which says like dual source or multiple transportable, and that's essentially all that means. So that's particularly important at those higher rates to avoid like gut discomfort and things. I might have missed something, but I think you said about the form of carbohydrate as well, which is in respect to things like you say, gels, chews, drinks. Ultimately, our muscles, when it gets to that point, don't know the difference between any of these things. So it will utilize them equally. However, getting it from our digestive systems to our muscles might be a limiting factor. So there is some kind of thought processes and a lot from anecdotal evidence as well, is that people struggle with more solid and chewy foods while running, particularly high intensities, than they do with gels and drinks, because it just takes more digesting, right? So people tend to opt for gels, drinks during a marathon, purely for convenience. And it's like 2 seconds to get a gel down, for example. So it's often a preferred source, and people don't often like them. And actually, like, this is a bit of a pet peeve of mine sometimes, is where people maybe don't give things like gels and things a chance. They just decide they don't like every single one ever. And they don't enjoy them, where they are a lot of money, but they're not there to be enjoyed. They're there for function. So if you actually can't tolerate them, that's a different story. But if you don't like them, then I'd say maybe sometimes just get on with it a little bit. Like you're doing a marathon. Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think I have heard some people say to me like, yeah, I hate a gel, and I just think to myself, you're not there to enjoy it. You're there to perform. So
yeah.
Pick like, your demons, right?
That's it. Yeah.
So, terms of dehydration, like what are the signs of dehydration and hyperhydration during a marathon? How would you manage these aspects?
Yeah, so that's quite a tough one, I think, to monitor. You need to remind people to be mindful and actually consider these things. I think some of the obvious ones will be things like thirst, like perception of thirst. If you're getting really thirsty, you need to drink, essentially. It is that simple. And to caveat that, on the other side, if you're going to the toilet loads and you need to keep stopping to the port-a-loos because you can't stop, emptying your bladder, then again, you may be taking a bit too much there. I think there obviously are more serious effects of dehydration as well, in kind of cognitive function and that kind of performance as well, but that might be a bit blurred with underfueling too. So I think it's for me, those are probably the two most simple things to be looking out for. And hopefully all this testing and stuff will be done well in advance of your race anyway, and you can test all of these things out. If you're working out how much you should be drinking, let's do that far in advance of the race. If you're then working out that, this bottle per hour actually means you're going to the toilet every half an hour, then that's probably enough to say that let's reduce it for your next long run the next week. If you're getting increasingly thirsty on your long runs, then okay, we need to increase it a little bit. So I think it's just making sure we prepare well in advance, and hopefully we don't have to be too mindful over this on the race itself. It's actually, the work's already done.
Awesome. Yeah. So again, it's just emphasizing that your long runs, your hill climbs, whatever, they're not the only part of the practice for your marathon running. You really need to consider all aspects of nutrition as well if you want to do well. So
yeah, that's it. And you can use it. You don't have to be, you can use it throughout the week as well in any sessions you do. But those kind of more long stuff is the only opportunity you have to take things on over a period of time. But also you have, presumably in the week you have sessions that are closer to your intensity that you might actually perform on a race day. So they're also important to practice too, so that you're used to taking things at the intensity that you will expect to on race day, because that will affect you. So.
Awesome. Thank you. So, now, again, so we've looked at hydration, we've looked at the macronutrients. Now, to talk about the electrolytes, and obviously most people will know, like we need to make sure that we have adequate electrolytes coming into the system. So I was just wondering, are there any specific types of foods or supplements that help with electrolyte balance during the race, or electrolytes not as much of an issue, but as you've alluded to, they're pretty important, right?
Yeah, I think the balance of electrolytes during a marathon or whatever we're doing are important. They play key roles in muscle function, like nerve conduction. Maintaining this fluid balance is important. However, like, I think the actual effect of electrolytes during exercise is pretty poorly understood. And I think most of the research doesn't support its use, at least not yet, like during exercise strongly. It's not to say that it doesn't happen. It's just there's not a lot to tell us that it's having an effect just yet. Not to say that I don't think they have their place. I think they do absolutely, but I think it's just not very, very well understood. And our body is okay at maintaining this balance anyway. So like it is important, but how important it is from like an external point of view and actually putting them into the body, I'm not too sure. I think leading into the race, that's probably a different story. And after races and training particularly, it's important to kind of store these before and replenish them after. And ultimately, like lots of like salty foods are going to be the best way to get electrolytes in particular. Sodium is the main one of interest really for many reasons, but other electrolytes and things that are important are like things like potassium, which we obviously find in things like bananas. So essentially a good diet will get all of the things anyway, but salty foods is a good way to do it. And you know, if you've got a particularly hot day, particularly long session, then your post exercise meal or even two of them, just put a bit of extra salt on there. We grow up getting told salt's bad for us, but again, this doesn't apply to athletic populations. Salting our foods a bit more is probably going to do you some good. Utilizing electrolyte supplements as well. I think they get used maybe or misused sometimes, but having them around is good, and particularly following exercise. Like on a morning of a marathon, for example, I think it's good practice to have some in your bottle and kind of you almost the theory is that you're like loading with water as opposed to carbohydrate, and we believe that it's you can achieve that pretty well within the morning. But yeah, when it comes to actually during exercise, I'm not sure I can give an amazing answer to tell you you need this amount per hour. I know there's a lot of things that do certain sweat tests and like sodium tests and things. And while these will give us information around how much sodium we lose in our sweat, we don't necessarily know the benefit of actually what if we do replace exactly what we lose during exercise. We don't know what the benefit of that is, particularly for something like a marathon, which, don't get me wrong, is a long day, but it's also relatively short. If we're then looking at things that last 10, 15, 20 hours, multiple days, okay, then we need to probably think about getting serious with this stuff. But I think otherwise it's first and foremost, let's just make sure that you're drinking enough. I think that's what we need to do before we worry about anything else. And I think if you're drinking enough and you're having exactly what we need, then you can have the conversation about how much electrolytes you need. But most people don't drink enough anyway. So I think focus on that first, and then we can hopefully by the time people have learned to do that, the science will be able to help us and understand the role of electrolytes a little bit better.
Awesome. Yeah, I actually heard Oscar Jürgen Drop saying, if you're really worried about your electrolytes, just have a pint at the end of your race.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you'll be fine.
Yeah, I think like that post-race beer or whatever it might be is actually, there's quite a lot of like science to support the use of that as well. And not that you need to do everything according to science, but it's a good excuse nonetheless.
Absolutely. So spoke about pre-nutrition, training, the actual run itself. But what about from a recovery perspective. So how soon should a runner start their recovery nutrition, and what do you recommend for it to include?
Yeah, so I mean, how soon should you do it? It's probably pretty soon. Get on it quite as soon as possible. That's going to depend on like how competitive the athlete is. You know, are you then looking to recover for the next week to get training again, or are you looking to complete this marathon, then put your feet up for a couple of weeks? But like, I think all of this should be like practical, realistic advice, because you should celebrate at the end of your marathon. Like, I'm not going to say you should then, okay, get right back on it again. But by all means, I think that post race recovery should, you know, commence fairly soon, but in conjunction with enjoying yourself as well. I think there are kind of like three R's. So we've used the three T's, but there's three R's we can use for recovery, which is like refuel, repair and rehydrate. And refuel will be around, I guess, refuel and replenishing those carbohydrates and that glycogen stores. So, ideally that's 1 to 1.2 grams per kilo of body weight of carbohydrate within that kind of post-exercise period. I don't think a lot of people take scales to them on the finish line of a marathon. So just hitting something near that is good. And then, you know, something that's practical, I think is the main thing. And you're not going to be able to get a meal immediately after. So it's something that's practical. That kind of next R is repair. So including a source of protein, you know, we hear 20 grams, but 20 to 40 grams in that post-race, period, is fantastic. You know, studies suggesting that, you know, maybe 3-to-1 ratio of carbohydrate to protein is particularly effective in recovery. Now, 3-to-1 ratio of carbohydrate to protein is pretty much found in a lot of milkshakes. So if you just take like a chocolate milkshake or something for the finish line, it's pretty tasty and it will probably hit exactly what you need it to. It is processed though, so that's the only problem. And then of course rehydrate as well. So actually the milkshake ticks this box too, but you know, replacing fluids that you've lost. Ideally we try and aim to replace 150% of the fluids that you've lost. So when you obviously looking to rehydrate, you initially think, okay, well, I just need to get exactly what I've had and then I'm back to normal. But there are other processes that are going on that use water. In that time period, you'll expend more water as well. But it's not, you don't just use water or lose water through sweat. You're also using it for other processes in your body. You also probably go to the toilet at some point. You're losing fluid there. So 150% of fluids within kind of 2 to 4 hours for this race, is genuinely recommended. But you often get like an alcohol-free beer or something on the finish line. So if you have something like that, a milkshake, then some water, then I think that's pretty perfect. That will then lead into your dinner, which remember you add a bit more salt to. And then, yeah, put your feet up. And I think it's just keeping on it the next little while. Your immune system will be a little bit compromised. So looking after that with, you know, the addition of lots of colours and textures from foods that are going to allow us to get lots of micronutrients in, and just like appreciating what you've done. This isn't from any science textbook, but I think it's important to sit down and appreciate what you've done. Not just the race, but the training as well. And some people will do a marathon and never want to run again. If you do want to continue or progress and whatever, then reflect on the journey. From a personal standpoint, but also on the topic of nutrition, what could you have done better? Because it's hard to believe anyone ever perfects a race. So understand, okay, what went wrong? How can you caveat that next time? And then it's about putting those things into place as well.
Awesome. That was beautifully said. I mean, yeah, people really don't think about the majority of these things. I think, obviously, those that want to train really hard, and I see people train really hard and not put that much attention to their nutrition, and they do think to themselves, like, oh, I trained so hard, how did I not manage to do X, Y, and Z? It's like, well, you just didn't look at the little details that make up the last 10%.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be really complicated. I know there's been, I've said a lot of numbers and things, but it doesn't have to be that difficult. And once you understand what an okay day looks like and how your exercise is going to be or affects what you might need, you can make decisions for yourself quite easily, and your training stuff will be pretty good from there on out. And then you're fueling your training well, so by that you're preparing and practicing for what you're going to do in the race. So your training and performance nutrition's then kind of covered. I think it's just being a bit mindful and critical about the things that we read as well.
Cool. So I'll start moving things a little bit quick, because obviously I don't want to waste too much of your time.
No, it's fine. I'm rambling, so it's my bad.
No, it's cool. I think people are appreciating it massively. The more information they get, the better, right? I'm sure everybody will agree with that. So I just want to ask now, in terms of intolerance to your carbohydrate intake, specifically during a marathon, we kind of alluded to it earlier about training the gut. Do you think you can just talk a little bit more about that? And then also maybe some common mistakes that people do around nutrition when preparing for a marathon, and maybe how can they avoid them?
Yeah, of course. I think they probably link together a lot, because I think a common mistake would be not training the gut. but yeah, this gut training kind of topic is one that's getting more and more familiarity. And it's essentially understanding that our gut, just like our muscles, has the ability to adapt and essentially improve its ability to handle carbohydrates. So it's not this kind of fixed organism, it's dynamic, and it can adapt to its kind of stimuluses. So the theory is that we improve our tolerance, like you say, to carbohydrate over time. To understand what our tolerances are to begin with can be difficult, and you might find out the hard way. So it's starting lower with what we take during our runs or our cycles, in terms of how much carbohydrate we might have per hour. I think that 30 grams per hour is a good place to start with this. And then every so often, or every week, say, we might increase that by 5-10 grams, and so on and so forth, depending on how much time we have before a race. If you have 30 and you're really hungry, or you're actually used to taking more on, then, you know, you don't have to just stick to this. You can go ahead a little bit, just use a bit of common sense there, I guess, and just not overdo it, and just give your body a bit of time and consistency. I think you'll be surprised of how much you can improve its ability to adapt over time, by doing things consistently, you know, throughout sessions in a week, on a weekend, just getting used to eating during exercise, which is something people generally are bad at doing. I think there's a definite psychological component of people not wanting to eat during exercise, even if their goals isn't to lose weight or anything. I think there is this conflict of interest between, okay, well, I'm expending calories now, I don't always want to be consuming them as well, but in relation to what you're expending, you're still only going to be taking on a small amount anyway, and it's going to help you essentially perform better. So yeah, there's no like a magic formula in terms of a gut training protocol. It's hard to do research on it, although it's getting better. There's no kind of set amount of weeks. Essentially, how long you've got is how long you've got. The longer, the better. And give yourself plenty of time. The more you can give yourself, you can experiment not just with amounts of things per hour, but like the types of foods you might go for, the different forms that we discussed earlier. And just accounting for all different circumstances, really. So, yeah. I think gut training is still got room for improvement in its kind of, in our knowledge in it, but also getting it, this information to people. Because people will often say that they just can't stomach things. Oh, I'd have a gel, but I can't stomach it. And it's like, okay, well, let's give that a go. Let's find something you can stomach and let's improve it. You know, don't write it off, completely. the reasons we do that is not just so we can take more on during exercise, it's so that we can perform better. That there's a functional reason for that, and the symptoms and the consequences of not doing that can be quite graphic and things we want to avoid on a race day, and you might be wishing they had more port to lose on the course, for example. And that kind of probably leads on to some of the common mistakes, which is that people don't practice what they're going to do. And that happens so much. And it is a shame, if nothing else, because people do put a lot of work into their training. And nutrition just allows you to kind of embrace that work and get the most out of it. It doesn't have to be really serious or weighing everything out. You know, you can take it to that level, of course, but it doesn't have to be something that is really demanding. It's just having a bit of understanding around it can make a whole lot of difference. So I'd say not preparing well is a huge one, and that's through a number of ways. Alternatively, people often try new things on race day when we know that's not a good idea. Introducing new foods or supplements can lead to an array of gastrointestinal issues or whatever it might be. It might just cause you stress. If you don't know what you're going to do on the race, you might be in bed the night before trying to plan things through your head and have a bad night's sleep beforehand. You might be really stressed about what you're going to do. Having a plan just alleviates any of that. I think that one of the most common mistakes probably is just under fueling in general. And this goes for the race and training. So not consuming enough calories or carbohydrates during training and the race, you know, leading to this kind of energy depletion. You know, in a race, that's where people hit the wall. There's a reason why you often hear people refer to like the 18th mile as like where the race starts or around that point, is because this is probably the point that people are depleting of glycogen. So if you eat well, I've experienced myself, you'll start overtaking everyone at 18 miles because you know, don't get me wrong, it's still hard. It'll hurt, but you're not empty of energy. You can just, I'm able to get past all these people. That's quite handy. I think, like I said earlier, the carb load, something people do wrong. It's understanding that it's not just a big meal the night before. It's beyond that, and it's just keeping it simple. It's beige, boring foods, but essentially all the foods you get told not to eat. Often it's that for a day or two. And then, yeah, maybe overhydrating a little bit as well, drinking too much water, particularly before a race. I think people have an idea that they need to be hydrated, and maybe anxiously drinking water, and then they can almost overhydrate there and disrupt that kind of balance of fluids and electrolytes. So one way to overcome that would be to drink a little bit less. Not to say you don't need to drink a lot in the morning, but if, you know, you're drinking loads, then that's probably not necessary. Or adding some electrolytes to your pre-race drink. Just this helps with retention of water. And also it might just, allow you to retain some of that water as opposed to going straight through. I think there are some common mistakes. I think there are probably a lot. But hopefully, you know, you're going to make some mistakes, probably either are, but I think it's learning from them as well. So the mistakes aren't always bad. Some you can avoid, but the ones that you don't, then understand why and try and learn from it.
Yeah, definitely. I think hopefully people realize that after this conversation, how detailed your responses have been. Should probably drop you a follow and just look at what your page says and kind of just stick to it. So before we get to we will get to that part in a second, but also I just wanted to double check with you about performance with supplementation during your races.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you would recommend? Obviously people hear about caffeine, but go.
Yeah. So yeah, I think caffeine is probably a good one to start with. It is the most extensively research drug worldwide, let alone within sports science. It's, you know, it's well shown to improve performance, and it increases like adrenaline, and it particularly works on by just reducing that perceived exertion. So it makes things feel a bit less hard or the pain a little bit less. And it kind of does work for, like, however, it's also to appreciate that it doesn't work for everyone. It can cause gastrointestinal issues. It insensitive individuals to caffeine, it can overstimulate them. It can, you know, enhance anxiety, like things like jitters and stuff. So it definitely works, but sometimes it can work maybe too well. And I think the research maybe suggests around, again, I'm going to throw some more numbers, but like 3 to 6 milligrams per kilogram per body weight around 30 to 60 minutes before exercise. There's also evidence to suggest it works during exercise as well. So some people might have some before, they might not have anything, they might just have their coffee and that'll do. And some people wait, you know, if they've got, they might think, okay, I know it's going to get hard. Like I said, at that 18 miles, they might take it about half an hour before they hit 80 miles. So that then hits to that point, and that last, you know, 8K or 8 miles, they'll have that support and boost from caffeine. So it's often reserved for like, for those hard periods, but it does take a bit of time to get to the system. So you've got to preempt it a little bit. I guess there's maybe a couple more, like, beta alanine or sodium bicarbonate, which has a lot of research to suggest, like, to that improves the buffering of like the acidity within muscles that we often kind of experience with, like, you know, burning muscles, and that can be shown to potentially delay fatigue in like really high intensity bursts, but probably not to the extent of a marathon. It's probably not quite extreme or like high intensity enough. Nitrates is one, so that's often found in things like beetroot juice, and that's kind of been where the most the research has been on that, and that works by essentially like encouraging and improving endurance by improving blood flow and oxygen use. And I think there's Andy Jones is a researcher who's called, I think he's in his Twitter or X now, it's called Andy Beetroot. So he's made a name off this supplement, and basically he showed a lot of work that it enhanced things like time trial performance and reduced oxygen costs through various effects. And again, it has an individual response, and actually it kind of more recently showed that it probably didn't have that effect on higher level athletes, shall we say, who probably already have those benefits that you'd get from nitrates from their high training volume. So it might be a supplement that's actually more beneficial for recreational or kind of like sub-elite athletes. I think there are others like creatine, maybe, but that'd probably have more of an effect on strength adaptations during training and might allow you to train a bit more effectively, and then you'd get the adaptation from better training as opposed to during a marathon. So I think probably caffeine and nitrates are the ones that, if any, could have some effects, but get the day-to-day diet and the carbohydrate plan and hydration plan sorted far beyond or before you worry about this stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Stick to the basics first. Sleep, carbohydrates, yeah. Training. And then then everything else can fall into place later once you've perfected those aspects, right?
Yeah.
Cool. And then
absolutely.
Yeah. And also, beetroot juice, you can't just go get some beetroot and just break down some beetroot and make it some juice. I'm pretty sure
that's a good point.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I think it's also got to do with nitrate concentration in the soil where they grow, and isn't it? It has a massive effect.
Yeah. So,
there's a lot of, you have to actually get the supplement. You can't just break down the beetroot.
Yeah. I think you can eat beetroots, but you have to eat in a significant amount of them, where it's probably going to do you more harm than good.
Yeah. And also, don't be scared if you're about to go to the toilet an hour before your race and you see that your colour's red. It's not because you're bleeding.
No.
Yeah. So then I just want to go into, because obviously we get some veggies, vegan, and then there's a low carb side of things. I just want to ask if those different diets can have an impact on performance.
Yeah, I think if we consider vegetarian and vegans, and I know it's not the same, but for the kind of the purpose of this, we can consider both those diets to some similarities. I think with proper planning, both these diets can support marathon training, no problem. I think we've obviously got some extra considerations to take, and it might be a little bit more difficult, but it's not to say it's not possible. So of the main thing will be things like protein, of course, which might be a bit harder to get within the diet. Or when I say harder, it might just take a little bit more thought into get, you know, a full kind of profile of protein in the diet. And that will also, relates to things like iron as well, and other micronutrients like calcium and certain vitamins like vitamins B12, which are all things that are found in animal products. So for vegetarians, obviously we can have things like eggs, milk, yogurts and things. So that might not be such a problem with some of these, but for certain vitamins are going to be solely found in certain types of meats. So I think it's just making sure that we're extra vigilant with our macro and micronutrient intake. But in regards to whether or not we can be successful, then absolutely we can. I think a lot of people who are going to be following these diets anyway are probably quite, if they're doing it and training for a marathon anyway, they're probably quite mindful of these things. So they could probably achieve this just fine. I think there's a recent study as well to suggest that like protein synthesis is as adequate with plant-based proteins, as long as it's the right amount, than like more animal-based proteins, which is something that's not always been believed to be the case. So that's quite interesting. If we look onto like low carbohydrate diets, that's maybe a different story in my opinion. But I think low carb diets, you see people who go against the grain and follow these things and do amazing. And I probably can't always explain why. And that's a good thing. I think it means that we don't know everything just yet, but I think it does mean that I think what we do know, and it's repeatedly been shown that lower carbohydrate availability around marathon or endurance activities is not beneficial specifically for performance. So people might do well off it, but my argument would be that they could probably do even better if they were doing something a bit different. If you look at events that are really long or have you can't get provisions, that you can't pick up carbohydrate, then being more adapted to use fat will have its benefits. You won't be able to go as quick, but you'll be able to get through it. So that's a different context, I think. Because essentially high intensity performance is compromised by lack of carbohydrate availability. And I think I'm quite confident to say that. And I think a lot of others would be as well.
Absolutely, yeah. People, I think it's the ATP production is something like 32 times more effective with carbohydrates than it is with fats, something like that. So
yeah,
carbohydrates are pretty important. Like everyone says, king of performance or queen of performance, whatever your preference.
Yeah, yeah, they're pretty good. I think in terms of diet, like the best diet is the one that provides sufficient energy and nutrients to support training, right? And how, if you can do that with other ways of doing it, if you've got other beliefs or you just prefer other foods or whatever, then absolutely. I think it's achievable. And I think a lot of people are continuing to go that way as well. So I think it's good news.
Definitely. And I think every time I go to conferences or like little seminars with nutritionists hosting the event, that always tell us, please tell people that carbohydrates are not the enemy. Let's get people understanding that carbohydrates are important. Well, like what you guys said, the Female Emporium in Liverpool, Jordan Moores, that was fantastic. I just hope that happens again at some point, because there's lots to learn there, obviously.
Yeah. I think we'll aim to do something like that again for sure.
Cool. And then finally, so last question, what are some practical tips for ensuring proper nutrition during travel for a marathon? Because like you said, lots of people tend to travel for a marathon.
Yeah. So I think we often tie it in with other things, if it's like a holiday or just to see another place. But it can be something that really derails someone's performance, because they're somewhere new, they're doing things differently, they're relying on other things. So I think all this comes down to planning, and it's not the funnest thing to do. I'm luckily a planner. A lot of the time I like writing lists and things, so it's in my nature, but I know it's not the most like exciting thing to do. So I think researching and planning ahead of time for like food options, look at your travel destination, identifying local like shops, restaurants, what are the facilities where you're staying, can you cook? If you can, then that's probably a good idea, at least before the race, so they can control a lot of things. If not, then yeah, what restaurants are going to provide the best options for you? Doing this thing in advance means that not only can you know what you're doing, but you can also book a table to somewhere that's probably quite busy if it's hosting a marathon that week. Pack like the essential stuff then, if it's, you know, packaged things like packaged rice, tins, your sports supplements or nutrition products that you want for the race, anything that you regularly use, take with you, it's familiar. It ensures that you have access to things that are familiar, even if it's in the case of an emergency. And that could be for like your carb load or the day itself. I guess if, like, when I think about traveling as well, I think actually the process of traveling, and like if you're going to get on an airplane, for example, then like staying like hygienic, and you're going to be around lots of people, both in an airport or on a plane or when you get to a race. So simple things like washing your hands, maintaining a good diet, getting good sleep, these like just all the things you know are good for you, just be extra on it that week. Flying as well, we know it dehydrates you a little bit, so just stay on it a bit with fluid intake. And that might be somewhere where you might want to take like an electrolyte as well, just to as like a precaution, if you like. Lots of people want to embrace in local like cultures and cuisines and stuff, but I'd say do that after the race. And you don't want to try something and it disagrees with you the night before. So just be slightly patient. People have trained a long time. Just wait a little bit longer. Practical tips is just stick to a routine that works for you and that you're used to as best as possible. I think just monitoring things, like if you go to a restaurant, like does it look safe and hygienic? Reputable restaurants and things are a good place to go before the race. Last but not least, I think like time zone is something to consider if you're going really far. If you're traveling across time zones, then you might like adjust things before you go, like your sleep or your food schedule, and you might do that so it aligns with like the new time zone, for example, just to allow you to adjust to things a bit easier when you get there. And I think there are a few travel tips. It sounds like I don't want people to have a good time when they go away. I do. I think it's just I want people to enjoy their races as well, and I think a lot of this stuff allows you to actually enjoy it more. You're less stressful about what you're doing once you're there. It's good. Hopefully where you're going, sunny too, so maybe pack some sunscreen.
Definitely. But you like, you're so right, you know. It's the amount of people I know as well, I suppose they're just like recreational athletes who pitch up and they're just like, oh, I boxed an ice restaurant the night before just to celebrate. And then I'm like, no, 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 do it the day after. You don't want to disrupt your training because you never know what could go wrong. Like control the variables and then, yeah, prepare as much as you can. The more you plan, the less stress you actually end up being. Don't throw a spanner in the works and everything goes bottle up. So anyway, thank you so much for your time. Absolutely incredible. So much knowledge, so much information there for people to go away with.
Yeah, I've absolutely thrown some stuff. Sorry, a bit of word vomit at some point, but yeah, hopefully it was all right.
No, more than all right. That was unbelievably detailed, and I can't thank you enough, genuinely. So can you just give everybody a bit more detail about where they can find you? Because I'm sure some people might even reach out to you. Who knows?
Yeah, I should probably know this thing off the top of my head a bit better. Instagram, I know that one. That's Fortis, that's FORTIS.sportsci, so it's SPORTSCI, sorry. It's got one S in the middle, basically. My Twitter is, I think, just my name, Harvey_Fortis, and that's probably the best places. And then, yeah, my email and stuff are all on there as well, but they're probably better.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your time. Much appreciated.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, mate.
Cheers.
Thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you found it useful, please share with a friend. They would also benefit from these talks. If you'd like to keep up with everything else I get up to, you can check out my Instagram at rich_performance_nutritionist and feel free to drop me a message with your thoughts and feedback on this weekly chat so far.